Welcome to Trashy Divorces.
Hey friends, I'm Alicia.
My name's Stacy.
Welcome back. We are running. We're running so far away this week.
Just like our subjects.
Using an English band, Flock of Seagulls, today for our theme. We do talk about two runners this week.
So we are bringing you a couple of our very favorite Patreon episodes from the vault. We like to do that every so often. Partly because our Sunday audience is considerably bigger than our Patreon audience, and we like to sort of share, like, good stuff with you, basically.
So we're going to run away today, take a little bit of a holiday. We have two holiday episodes from Patreon over this past year. My story this week was recorded from St. Patrick's Day. It was the I Feel Lucky relaunch of Fun With Dunn. I have done two seasons now of a whole different adjunct series about Dominic Dunn and his writings, and it gets all my true crime adjacent stuff out because I have a partner
who's not really into true crime.
Yeah, it's not really your thing. So back in March of this year, back St. Patrick's Day of this year, I covered the story of Lord Lucky Lucan, who was not so lucky in his trashy divorce, but he does have a mysterious disappearance. I feel like it's an interesting story.
It's like the nanny who's really not lucky in the story, right?
It's all bad. Fun With Dunn is very good. Hope y'all enjoy that one. Stacy, this week you pulled out one of your favorites.
We do a lot of very feminist storytelling on Patreon, and I think on the Sunday feed too, but I have been compiling a group of stories that I've kind of put under the banner I call Loose Women. These are women who liberated themselves in unexpected times, and they lived fascinating lives. So that's included the pirate Anne Bonny, a French opera star and sword fighter known as La Maupin, and today's story, Vita Sackville-West. Vita was an English writer best known for her affair with, Virginia Woolf, but she lived a genuinely exceptional and occasionally outrageous life that deserves more celebrating. And so that is what we shall do today.
It was a well-done story. So thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We've got a few from the vault today. Before we get to our episode, let's pull out the magic mirror.
Let's pull out the magic mirror and say a big thank you to our new patrons, Ariel B., Jocelyn H., Kayla G., Jeff W.,
Amanda K., Jacqueline G., Jillian B., and Aaron, welcome on as a new super supporter. Thank you, new patrons, existing patrons. Thanks for supporting our independent trashy podcast dreams over here. We are so appreciative.
We are so grateful for you.
And the very best.
And for you, Sunday listeners.
And Sunday listeners, we encourage you to head on over to Patreon. Stacy, there's a link.
Sure.
That you actually organized this week.
I sort of did. Check your show notes. I actually indexed everything at the bit.ly/trashcandyquarantine. That index is on our website, helpfully, but there are links to the stories, so you can go check it out. It's kind of organized a bit.
So, like, over there, totally for free.
It's not trashy at all. It's completely off-brand for us.
So, totally for free on that bit.ly/trashcandyquarantine link. There are 30-plus episodes, all in these different trashy spider web rabbit hole candy piles we play down. Loose Women and Side Pieces and Ocean's 11 and Trashy Tutors and Sisters and Dirty Digs and Trashy Melodies. Totally free episodes. If you run out of those, consider joining us on Patreon, patreon.com/trashydivorces.
That's us.
So today you get two pretty fun examples of what we do over there, stories we really liked.
We hope you like them too.
How lucky do you feel? You ready to pull a runner on this episode?
I think perhaps we should go. So you're bringing back the fun, yeah?
I'm bringing back the fun. All the fun.
All the fun with Dunn?
This is what happens.
The Fune with Dune?
Oh, my God. Y'all, welcome to Fun with Dunn.
Welcome back.
The 200 series.
The next generation.
That's exactly what it is. So here's the deal. You've asked. I've listened. Welcome back to Fun with Dunn.
Fune.
with Dune.
Dune.
The 200 series. I'm here for it. There have been threads that I've left, cases we haven't gotten into. People are excited about Fun With Dunn. I'm excited about Fun
People
With
are Dunn. Absolutely excited about Fun With Dunn. I think what you're trying to say is that this is going to be a monthly feature. It'll drop on a Tuesday and life is good.
This will be a monthly recurring feature dropping on a Tuesday. Yes, and life is good.
Boom, look at
Boom.
That.
Solved.
Email us your questions at probablytuesdays at gmail.com.
Maybe, maybe not. Are there tacos?
Okay.
Today, Fun With Dunn, we're going to start with one of the most mysterious happenings that our man Nick covered. It's true crime adjacent. It's loaded with a trashy divorce-ish, too.
Perfect. So far, so good.
Today is a story. Do you feel lucky?
Maybe.
I feel lucky. It's the story of Richard John Bingham and his wife, Veronica Duncan Bingham, otherwise known as Lord and Lady Lucan.
Oh, sure. Lucky Lord Lucan.
That's exactly right. Who looks just like
Bradley Pitt.
Oh, my God. Would so Bradford
Pears
in the movie.
Yeah, you told me to look up a picture of him, and like he does, in fact.
The resemblance is remarkable.
Brad Pitt needs to slap a little mustache on, but that's pretty much the only difference.
So, listeners, when you are hearing this story about Lord Lucan, who will also go by his nickname of Lucky.
Lucky Lord Lucan.
St. Patrick's Day. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. Mm-hmm. This is why we're doing Lucky Lucan today on the It's Your Lucky Day Fun With Dunn is Back. They've got a lot of threads. I got a lot going on in my brain.
As you should.
Quarantine brain just gets me creative. Okay. Lord Lucan is born December 18th, 1934. He is the oldest son of the 6th Earl Lucan. And he's a boy. He's the only boy in a family otherwise full of girls. So life is going to be pretty groovy for him. He will have to battle with the sins of his ancestors. So the 3rd Earl of Lucan, his great-great-grandfather, directed the catastrophic charge of the light brigade.
Oh, I was going to say, is this about the Crimean War? In my brain, I was like, where would that put it back in history?
Okay. Yeah, so the charge of the light brigade is one of the most famous disasters in British military history. It resulted in the massacre of half a division in the Valley of Death at Balaclava. Oh, look at me. During the Crimean War.
Mm-hmm.
This.
And there's a very famous poem about it.
Oh, there you go. Is it by Thomas Wolfe?
Tennyson.
I'm kidding.
Charge of the Light Brigade. It's a very
William
famous
Faulkner.
Poem.
Is he always it's the
probably
answer?
Probably William Faulkner, okay. Noted English poet.
Anyway. The 3rd Earl of Lucan, great-great-grandfather, has done some stuff that hasn't been great in...
Little military flub.
Correct.
There. Costs a lot of lives.
So this brings disgrace to the name of Lucan.
And Lucky here is like, watch this.
Well, yeah, don't worry. Like, people will forget about the 3rd Earl soon enough because the 7th Earl is going to be the first English peer in 200 years to be tried for murder.
To annihilate his family.
Let's get there. He's born again, 1934. Things are going great, except for World War II happens. But his parents have a little cachet in the world. And they get their kids evacuated out to Wales in 1939. The kids then head over to Toronto after Wales becomes a little bit too hot. Eventually, the kids will go and live with a rich American lady, not lying, by the name of Marcia Brady Tucker until the end of the war.
Marcia, Marcia, Marcia.
So like most families that are in the peerage, when the war ends, little Lord Lucan comes back to England and will attend Eton, where all the other little Lord Lucans go.
Eton?
Yeah.
How is that Eton. Pronounced? Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Eton College. I'm pretty sure.
I don't know.
English listeners, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's it. Eton.
Okay.
I haven't eaten today, have you? Okay.
I had some bread.
At Eton, Lord Lucan is going to begin his love affair with gambling. and risk and all of his addiction proclivities, let's say. Eaton will give him an opportunity to fully develop these skills as a fucked up dude. It will also give him the name of Lucky. He will complete his national service in 1953. He will serve for a year as a lieutenant. He fulfills the obligation for national service.
I think you mean lieutenant.
Lieutenant.
Lieutenant, because in that Russell Crowe sailing movie, trust me.
Sailing? I don't know that movie. I tend to think none about Russell Crowe. Zero.
Okay, sorry. Lieutenant.
Okay. Lucky fulfills his 1 year as a lieutenant in the service.
He would be Lucky Lieutenant Lucan, wouldn't he?
Some guys have all the luck. In 1954, Lucky's going to get a cushy job at a merchant bank. But Lucky isn't so lucky in the workplace. Doesn't love it that much. He's not that great at banking. What he really enjoys a whole lot more is being at the Claremont Club.
Sounds like more fun than work.
What's the Claremont Club?
Yeah, okay, that too.
It is a big-time rich people club owned by a dude named John Aspinall. You can get dinner. You can also pretty much mostly gamble with other rich people, other peers, other friends with rich dudes. And eventually, the Claremont Club is way more exciting than the merchant bank. So Lucky, when he is passed over for a promotion, has a really good night at the tables. Wins 26,000 pounds.
Wow.
And he's like, fuck this regular gig thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to be a professional gambler.
Woo! Good life choices all around.
We're going to leave him with those life choices, sitting at the Claremont Club at the Baccarat table. And we're going to meet our bride, Victoria Duncan. Lady Lucan, before she is a lady, is Victoria Duncan. She's 26. It's 1963.
Luck be a Lady Lucan tonight, but not.
She's an innkeeper's daughter. She works as a secretary and a model. Like, she's not
did every woman
close
in,
to the peerage.
Did every woman in London work part-time as a model in the 1963? 50s and 60s?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Correct.
I'm wondering if she knew the Profumo people.
They're all birds. They're all birds. All right. In 1963, little Victoria has been invited. She's 26. Has been invited by her sister, Christina, who is married to another peerage.
Lame-ass peer, yeah.
Yeah. Named William Shand Kidd. This is not Princess Diana's stepfather. That is Peter Shand Kidd. But they're all Shand kids and everybody's related.
Who isn't a Shand kid, really?
Veronica is staying with her sister and her brother-in-law. And Veronica sees Lucky across the room. He's 29. He looks a little different than other men. Now, her sister, Christina, has already given Veronica the dish. Girl, he has socialist parents. Did you hear about the charge of the Light Brigade? Also, he's a professional gambler, and it's said that he's queer. Lady Lucan will say that that last bit is not true. He actually was a fine specimen of a man. But seriously, after hours of research, I don't think these two liked each other very much. But they did like to fuck. So that weekend goes well enough. He asks her to dinner next Tuesday. The love affair is on. And I say that with a questioning thing. She's 26, and she will say she was approaching the age that women get on the shelf. He's 29. He's a landed British peer. He needs to have a son.
Right.
So
there was a lot of, this would all, on paper, work really well for us, kind of.
Yes.
Okay.
Now,
and it didn't.
It did not. No, it goes very, very badly.
Burn that paper.
Very badly. But I want to add in a little bit about their courtship here. Lucky is a big-time boater. He loves boats. He likes competing. And there's this big speedboat race that he is assured in his boat, the Migrant. Yeah, that he's going to win.
The Migraine.
Now, there's a White Migrant and a Migrant. And, like, anyway, I've watched a lot of stuff. Okay. So, Lucky is so convinced that he is going to be lucky and win, he will hire a plane and a film crew to film him doing the boat race so no one misses his big win and race of glory.
How's that go?
Well, they were first, and they were about to win. And Lucky, as you will see, as a nickname, is not always exactly true for Lord Bingham. A hole busts through the hull of the boat, and the entire operation is sunk before they could cross the finish line.
So he, like, hit a rock or something, and okay, great.
Okay.
Boats, boats, boats.
Like, Lucky is not... Boats, boats, boats. Lucky is not as good of a nickname, probably, as he should have.
Would have liked, yeah.
Veronica and Lucky get married. The wedding is sparsely attended. Lady Lucan will say no one liked either of them. There's no one there. Like, there was no one there to celebrate because no one cared and no one liked us.
Lucky and Ronnie getting hitched.
There was one notable guest, Princess Alice, the mother of Prince Philip. Mountbatten.
Who is the current consort to the queen?
Correct.
That guy? Okay.
His mom.
The Greek one? Okay.
His mom, yeah, was there. Princess Alice. I'll follow up on her one day. She's an interesting story. Okay, woo! Way to go, kids. They meet and they marry all in 1963, so they know each other very well. It all just goes bad. For a wedding gift, Claremont Club owner John Aspinall gives them £200 to spend at the club. Lucky's going to blow through that quick and end up that night losing £8,000. £8,000.
God, I would honestly be sick if I were to lose $8,000 gambling.
Well, hold on. It's going to lead to a very unhappy Christmas for the newlyweds because he only had $9,000 that he got from the insurance on the sunken boat back in the race. Now they're broke. But they're only, they're not for very long. 6 weeks later, the sixth Lord Lucan dies.
Oh.
Long live the seventh Lord Lucan.
Bum, bum.
Now the couple has titles, money, land, a golf course. There is a substantial injection of cash, which is excellent because Veronica is pregnant with their first child. What do we need?
A baby to save our marriage.
No, we need a boy.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You forget, you're in England, babe. You're in England.
Once we get this taken care of, we can see whoever we want.
Not a boy. It's a girl. Frances. But Lucan's like, sure, now a family man. They're going to buy a home at 46 Lower Belgrave Street in London. They will buy that home for £17,500 with curtains and carpets included. It's a steal. Okay, so the idea that Lucky Lucan is ever going to be a family man is sort of laughable.
Right.
He's addicted to gambling. She's trying to be a mom, but they have this image to keep up. I don't know. It's probably not keeping up with the Joneses in England, keeping up with the next door, with the Chumleys. I don't know.
Well, I mean, honestly, the scene... London in the early 60s.
They're in the scene.
Yeah, like this is really taking me back to the Profumo affair story seasons ago.
Yeah. They don't have the money to be in the scene, but they're going to do it anyway. So they're in that like Mayfair jet set scene. Lucky will oil up to John Aspinall. Remember, you don't know this. I'm saying remember, but here's the thing you need to know about John Aspinall. He's made a fortune taking the money from rich landed Englishmen and putting it into his own coffers. He has enough money to begin, own, and operate not one but two zoos. I said zoos, private zoos, just for him, where he goes out and plays with fucking tigers every day. Okay.
Good luck to your arms.
One day, Lucky and John Aspinall talk, and even though it's unseemly AF, Lucan is going to take a gig at the Claremont Club They start a baccarat game in which Lucky will get a percentage of the bank, but it's pretty undignified for a peer to be a card dealer, but he does bring other high rollers out. The first few years with Lucky and Veronica are okay as a couple. It's not great. There's gambling. He's got some problems with alcohol. That's soon going to turn to drugs and heroin and uppers and downers, so that's fun.
Yay!
Veronica will have a son, George, so the pressure's off about the heir. This is about 4 years into their marriage, and again, they're jet set. Here's what is so interesting. The kids will go to different seasides with their nannies for vacation, but the parents will go to Monte or Monaco. Okay, so Lady Lucan... I'm not talking a lot about Dominic Dunn in this. We're going to talk about him in a minute because he does write about part of this. But he wrote, Dominic Dunn wrote in 1993, and there's a little bit more info that has been revealed since then. So this is Lady Lucan being interviewed back in 2016. The interviewer upon this part where Lady Lucan's talking about the children went to the seaside. They were just with their nanny. We were in Monte Carlo. And the interviewer almost can't get it out. And he's like, doesn't that like feel cold? Isn't that cold? And just with the chill, she says, all of my relationships are cold. Yeah. Yeah. It was a fascinating.
Hashtag team stiff upper lip.
Lord and Lady, again, will head to exotic vacations. They don't have the money to do this, but they're keeping up appearances. Like, I'm not going to say he always loses at gambling, because sometimes he does win, but you should see their home movies. They're just kind of amazing, and they're in all these locales. And he loves filming her in, you know, here we are in Venice, floating through the here we are in Monte, here
we are.
So
he was doing selfies, in effect.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But by 4 years in, cracks are starting to form in the relationship. She says he was not a good communicator. And even though they're going to all these exotic places and traveling and have this life of like jet set awesome, she says they never enjoy each other as a couple in any of those places. They're always on their own, which I found was kind of sad. Like, it's the point of travel with,
yeah,
you have an adventure together. That was kind of heartbreaking. And when Veronica talks to him about that, this is so bad. Lucky's like, yeah, that's the point of marriage. I got married to you so I didn't have to talk to you. Yeah.
They are not built for the podcast era.
So it is no wonder that 4 years in with a son, because remember, married women into landed families, you gotta wait until you have a son to fuck anybody else. Mm-hmm. It's about that time. And it's no wonder that Lady Lucan begins a flirtation with this dude named Greble Howard, who by all accounts looks way better than her husband. They have dinner at the Claremont. Their phone calls. Lady Lucan says they had never gone to the fatal end. What a way to describe that. We never went to the fatal end. But Lucky Lucan will get wind that this is going on, and he goes to Howard and warns him off. And Howard's like, fuck, I'm terrified, and drops all contact with Veronica, who all of a sudden is depressed and despondent and takes to her bed, and she's really sad because of the sudden rejection. Lucky sees her in her bed, and now he's like, great. I can call you mentally unstable.
As a, like, divorce ploy, yep, or something? Okay.
Now we'll begin her battle with mental instability, which if she wasn't mentally unstable or vulnerable before, his behavior will make her so.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I've been rejected. I want to lay in bed and eat ice cream. Like, you're my husband. I can't tell. Like, but okay. It seems all perfectly explainable. But now hubby's in charge of her medical care, and he finds male doctors. So think F. Scott Fitzgerald here. Lucky's paws are all up in her. She certainly isn't fit to have kids. He he's outright cruel to her. And I purposely kept some of the details out of this story because the true crime aspect is gory, but I know that you don't have the stomach for that.
I've heard the story before.
I know. This part is salacious and is not really needed except for one key component, which will be a big deal when we get to our crime scene investigation. After this, Lord Lucan will beat Veronica 10 lashes with a cane. He will do this 3 times. I think this is a very strange and unusual way to talk to your partner about maybe you'd like to explore SM tendencies, because afterward he is affectionate. There's a lot of mental gaming here. But what I do want you to know, he's wanting to punish her. This is your punishment for, and it's a warped psychological, very unhealthy thing. But the thing I want you to know is with that cane that he beats her with, he wraps in sticky plasters. He wraps in Band-Aids. Plasters are what they're called in England from top to bottom. He wraps that cane in Band-Aids.
To soften it or?
Don't know. I don't know why. I just want you to remember that little bit.
Okay.
They are going to have another daughter together in 1971, because certainly that will fix the falling apart marriage. Mm-hmm. And Veronica, in addition to having a husband who is trying to make her think she's crazy, she's also suffering from severe postpartum depression. And he is, I'm using air quotes here, making efforts to help. Like getting her committed to the asylum.
It's a good effort.
And she's like, yeah, that's not going to happen. So the doctors will send her home with a lot of pills and sessions with a psychiatrist who goes to her home. But now Lucky is drinking and drugging, and he's using uppers and downers and heroin, and he's losing money hand over fist with a wife that he cannot control anymore. And he begins this plan to really undermine her with doctors. Again, F. Scott. Is she a fit mother? Now, they're not even divorced. No papers have been filed for divorce, but they are going to be in court trying to take the kids. And her doctors are like, nah, man, like, she's fit. Sorry, she's a fine mom. Like, you don't have anything here with this. And one night in 1973, Lucky will pack up 2 bags and leave their home at 46 Lower Belgrave Street, never to return. Well, he will return, but gone. He doesn't live there anymore.
Yeah, he's out. Okay.
And Veronica, like, thinks he'll be back for a while, but he just isn't. So she's going to go to a solicitor, a top barrister, and file papers on him for desertion. She needs money. She needs money to take care of the kids and the house and the bills. And, oh, God, this is shitty. Lucky will end up kidnapping the kids. And she goes to the police, and the police are like, we can't do anything. This is their parent, too, which begins this whole cycle, like a year of court wrangling. And it's messy. Lucky's going to hire PIs.
I'm surprised that he wanted the kids. I guess this is just really to fight with her. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, it's I don't want you to win. And it's so bad. He'll hire PIs. He will befriend every nanny on the block of other families in order to get dirt on her. He will provoke her on purpose on phone calls to get a rise out of her. So he's recording those at the same time and taping them. Okay. Remember, drugs, all of this, this is horrible. This is a horrible example of behavior. He's losing money hand over fist. One of these rounds is going to cost him about £20,000 to take her to court. He loses. Mm. He ends up looking really badly in this custody fight because all of these like machinations that he's doing like look way worse on him than they reflect on her. Here's the fair victory of it all, though. She's granted full custody with a nanny.
Okay.
He will get every other weekend and half holidays, but the court does not add on any need a nanny rule to his custody.
Okay.
The world is always so fair to women, isn't it? Bad stuff's about to happen, but I don't want to fool you. Like, she is not a sympathetic character. He is not a sympathetic character. neither is she. But you can elicit a little bit more sympathy for her because she just gets screwed over and over and over. All right. This takes us to September 1974. Lucky is $60,000 in debt. He is given 13 lots of the Lucan family silver to Sotheby's to auction.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. He's borrowing and begging for money. He's got big problems in Pier City, right? This one. But luckily for Veronica, she's found a very nice nanny, a lady named Sandra Rivett, who perhaps a little earlier has been pregnant and had a child and given that child up for adoption. Sandra's a lovely girl. And the Lucan kids, now 10, 7, and 3, really like Sandra, and she's hired. Trajectories are set. But have I mentioned never to trust a drugged-up aristocrat? 2 months later, November 7th, 1974, it's a Thursday night. What I'd like you to know in England is Thursday nights are nanny's night out.
Okay, didn't know that. And that does seem very germane, given what's about to happen.
Lord Lucan has a plan. He's borrowed a car. He has a United States mail sack. He has a lead pipe wrapped in sticky plasters. Band-aids.
I really don't understand the purpose of all that.
He will use a key and slip quietly into the home at dark. It's just his tell. It's a it's a signature. It's an MO. It's a signature thing. Like, if anybody's like, oh, I don't think Lord Lucan really did it. Nah, dude, you have the same tell on your weapon.
Who takes the time to wrap your murder weapon in Band-Aids?
A sadistic fucker?
Yeah.
Named Lord Lucan? Okay, he uses the key. He slips quietly into the home at dark. He's waiting in the downstairs where the kitchen is because it's Nanny's night out. And he knows every night before bedtime, his wife goes to get a cuppa. He unscrews the light bulb. He's waiting, lying in wait. The only light's available from the hallway. He knows his wife goes to bed at 9 o'clock. At 9 o'clock, she's going to come down those stairs and make a cuppa. And all of his problems are about to be solved.
See, you wonder why I stay up so late.
That's funny. So upstairs, on Nanny's night out, is Lady Lucan. She's chilling with the oldest kid, 10-year-old Francis, watching the telly. They're watching the $6 Million Man. And remember that nice nanny, Sandra? She's so sweet. She stops by the master bedroom to see if Lady would like a cuppa, because she's going down to make herself one, because Sandra's changed her night off. And Lady Lucan's like, thanks, Sandra. That would be really nice. And off Sandra goes. It's like 9 o'clock.
Sure. It's exactly the way Lord Lucan planned it, except...
So a little while later, Francis and Lady Lucan look at each other and like, yeah, well, I wonder where... This home is 5 floors. So the kitchen's on the very bottom. The master is...
Yeah.
So you wouldn't necessarily hear anything in a room many floors above.
A struggle and clunk, clunk, clunk.
Okay. Let me go check. Veronica sees a dark hallway and calls out, and then hears a sound and motion, because what has happened is that Lucky and his drug and alcohol-fueled plan has determined the only way to remove himself from this relationship was to kill his wife.
Right, but he fucked that up.
And now he hears his wife's voice at the top of the stairs, and he is looking at a battered body of what he thinks on his wife that he has just killed, and that is not his
right
wife.
But it is now Nanny's night out.
Oh.
Sorry.
Your humor sometimes is very dark.
We don't, this is why true crime is just, there are all the reasons we can't do true crime.
Okay, we're about to get to the mystery part, though. He will go after Veronica. Not with the initial rage shown to Sandra. Veronica is beaten on the head. He tries to choke her. She will squeeze his testicles to make him stop. And here's where Veronica gets smart. Okay, Francis, the kid, is like, what's going on down there? So they put the kid back to bed. And here's where Veronica's like, oh, Richard.
When you say they put the kids back to
bed. Yeah, they put the kids back to bed. She's got a bloody head, but everything's fine. It's stories alter in this a little bit, but I'm going to give you the what I can't account for. She starts playing it. Honey, I'm on your side. Let's get rid of the body. I can stay inside for a few days. No one will see this. It's fine. Please don't kill me. I'll help you. We can get you out of this. Because the problem that he did have is no longer his new problem. Okay? She's buying time. The body of Sandra Rivett will get into that sack. And Veronica never says she helped him with that, but there is cross-contamination. Her blood is found in mm-hmm. that. So I think she will help. She just won't admit it. But she's trying at this point to stay alive. So he asks if she has sleeping pills. And she's like, yeah. So they head off to get the sleeping pills. He will bring her the pills. And when he is off in the bathroom to get water, she thinks that, of course, he's trying to drug me so he can just smother me. He doesn't want to do the rage thing down there, but he's going to get me to sleep and then kill me anyway. She will wait, Veronica, for him to go to the bathroom and turn the water on. And she splits in the fastest ready to fucking run ever. And she heads down all those flights of stairs, out the door, turns left, and makes it to the end of the block where the Plumber's Arms pub is. So she busts through the door, pajamas and blood-soaked, and a bunch of drunk pubgoers are like, what the fuck? But she's going to get enough attention to have the police called, get tended to, and then get hospitalized for head injuries. She will survive this. The bigger mystery is what the fuck happens to Lucky. Because he doesn't anticipate her taking off. And now he's really fucked, right? So he is going to take off in the stolen car. Not stolen, borrowed car. He's going to go by a friend's house. And it's late. And that friend, her husband isn't home. And she's not going to answer the door to a frantic knock in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
There's a phone call to her after, but it's just noise. Like, she doesn't understand what the... Okay. By 11:30, Lucky shows up at this home called Grant's Hill Farm. Grant's Hill Farm. It's the home of Ian and Susan Maxwell Scott. And he comes in, and he, right, has had almost 2 hours to work on his story. And Lord Lucan's like, I've been in a struggle. And they're going to think I'm the one who's done this, but I fended off a murderer. And so he's going in, inventing this cover story to his friends. He's totally lying. He's going to write two letters at the Maxwell Scotts. Both of them are to his brother-in-law, William Shand Kidd. Both of these letters are in reference to the kids. One of them is like, tell them good things about me. You know, tell them the truth. Tell them I didn't do this, blah, blah, blah. The other letter is about legal matters. What my bills are, who can pay, who can wait. There will be a third letter written to one of his best friends, like, tell my kids the truth. He writes three letters that go, if you look at them from denial to reckoning to acceptance to he's made some sort of plan, but nobody knows what the plan is. So by the time the morning papers hit, the headlines are scandalous. Nanny murdered. Missing Earl. He's gone. He's gone like the wind. The borrowed car is found in this port town called New Haven, which is near the river that will get you into the English Channel. In the boot of the car is a bottle of vodka and another lead pipe wrapped in fucking sticky plasters. New Haven is also where Lord Lucan has his boat docked. There's also a ferry that leaves from Newport. So there's a lot of different escape ports if you're trying to get out of town. But here begins the mystery. You want to take a breath? I need to take a breath.
Well, the mystery is he's gone, right? And he's never seen
gone.
Again.
Gone. He's never seen again. Yeah. So it's no mystery that he killed poor Sandra. There is a coroner jury trial, which because of this case, he is tried in absentia for murder and found guilty. The think that this is the last time it happens in England. It's outlawed in 1976, we can't believe you did that to a peer and tried him without. So you can't do that anymore in England because of fucking Lord Lucan. He is found guilty. The manhunt is spectacular. They are searching country houses high and low. Where's your priest hole, ma'am? You know, there are sightings all over. It becomes an international manhunt. Like, where's Lord Lucan?
And no one ever finds mustachioed Brad Pitt.
Uh-uh. No, it clearly went to America and had an affair with Brad Pitt's grandmother. We can solved. Okay. So, a few ideas about what could have happened. Death by suicide. It's easy enough to slip into a boat, weigh himself down. He already had the weights because this is what he was going to do with Veronica's body. Puncture the hole, drown at sea. He knows how to sink a boat. He could have just done to himself what the plan, right, was going to be to her and just get rid of the evidence. This is where, and you're like, finally, Alicia, talk about Dominic Dunn. Dominic Dunn has an article called The Gentleman Vanishes in the Vanity Fair issue from May 1993. I've used Dominic Dunn for details in this, but I've specifically kept this sort of out of the writing because I would like you to go and read that. Fun with Dunn's going to take a little bit different of a turn where we're going to deep dive into like updates on cases that Dominic may have investigated. I'd like you to read that article and just his breathless way of telling about this manhunt. Okay. Lucky knows how to sink a boat. Maybe he's long dead. Maybe he jumped the ferry and jumped off the ferry to land in the propellers. Like maybe he was dead that night. I mean, he wrote like OJ letters, tell my kids, very similar to that vein. The morning before the murder happens, I want you to know that Lucky met with his top barrister, his solicitor, and throughout the law business that they were doing, Lucky attained the information that without a body, they cannot declare you dead for 7 years. So there would be no probate that would go to his widow for 7 years if his body isn't found.
Mm-hmm.
And it fucks her for 7 years and would allow his children to come of age without ever letting her be in the mix of that. It's kind of petty. You can see how that might be of interest to the case. There's also a lot of speculation that his rich and powerful friends helped scurry him out of the country. Maybe he made an escape. He would have needed his friends to do this because at his apartment they find passport, clothes, his glasses, money, everything that you'd normally, like your glasses. You take your glasses with you if you're going to make an escape. Like, mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe he escaped that night out of New Haven. Maybe he escaped at a later date and New Haven was just a ploy to distract. Maybe he even was murdered by moneylenders that he was in debt to and they found a really nice way to tie up their loose ends, getting him out of the way. There's also a rumor, maybe he was fed to the tigers at John Aspinall's zoo. This is what John Aspinall's mother said. John Aspinall's mom and Lucky Lucan are extremely close. They're like, she's substitute mom for him. So she kind of in jest says, oh, I heard he got fed to the tigers at the zoo. Dominic Dunn is convinced that Lord Lucan is alive and out of the country. Dominic Dunn knows Aspinall and all the other fat cats that Lucky hangs with, including Klaus von Bülow is friends with Lucky Lucan. And there's always something there that Dominic Dunn is sniffing around to discover. And he's like, you guys are so touchy when I bring this subject up that you all squirm. And I don't think you'd be quite this squirmy touchy if there wasn't a there there. But in the Mayfair jet set, Lucky is lauded. This is where the narrative turns because Veronica is unpopular and nobody likes her and she's not our kind anyway. And like everybody kind of there's some delicious writing in this article. I encourage you to read it, May 1993. In 1999, Lucky is declared dead, but no death certificate is issued. That will not happen until 2016. So I want to give you an update on Veronica. She has custody of the kids until 1981, where her trauma, mental instability, addictions will cause the courts to actually take her kids away from her and be put into being fostered by her sister Christina and her brother-in-law, William Shan Kidd. She will not speak to those kids for 35 years. No contact with her kids once she gives up custody.
Both of these adults sound like really strange people.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine how this fucks up your kids? It fucks her up too.
Sounds like she already was. The sending them to separate vacations with, like, I mean, I get that you can do that sometimes, but if that's just like how it works. Oh, it's summertime, kids. Go have fun at the shore with the nanny and we'll see you in the fall.
I mean, like, the kids, by all accounts, have a much better life growing up with their aunt and uncle. Like, they're all very, like, well-adjusted. They're all very successful.
Yeah. No, it sounds like their parents were both nightmare people.
In the last few years, Veronica made it to her 80s. She was living in the Muse house behind the house on Belgrave. She will, in 2017, self-diagnose herself because her hand shakes one day and she thinks she has Parkinson's. So she begins to plan her death by suicide, which will happen a few months later via alcohol and barbiturate poisoning. But the story's not over. When she dies, she will cut all three children out of her will. She will say, their lack of good manners and reverence shown to me has caused me to make this decision. She will donate her £600,000-ish to a charity supporting the homeless called Shelter, which I am sure that organization appreciated. And her kids, like, always very proper in their statements, which is kind of remarkable. There's never a bad word issued or said about either one of their parents. I can't even imagine how much therapy those kids have had.
Yeah.
Okay, but the story's not over. There's a dude, Neil Berryman, who says that he, big reveal, is the secret son that was adopted, whose mom is Sandra Rivett, the nanny who was murdered. And he wants her murderer found and held accountable. So this dude, over the last few years, has spent about £30,000 of his own money to hire private investigators. It, I think, looks a lot like the Dursley's mailbox, that he just gets all these anonymous letters in the post with all of these hints and allegations. But every time he does, he gets them investigated
and takes them
to the authorities.
Let's use the term peer group, but like this whole setup, they would have had, you know, homes in the Riviera. They would have, you know, like compounds in the wherever, and they could easily hide a person for an extended period of time.
So this
is quite a bit of luxury.
So this is Dominic Dunn's gushy, gushy article, mm-hmm. The Gentleman Vanishes, because he talks about the 100-acre island that someone has that can hold 50 comfortably, 100 in a push. Like, there are places that Lucan could have gone and never been.
That's going to go mess with. Yeah.
Never been seen again. So he could be living off the largesse of his friends. Sandra Rivett's kid is still determined to bring him to justice. Although Lord Lucan would be 86 by now and probably is more than likely dead if he wasn't already in 1974 when the whole nefarious thing happened. I feel lucky. Lucan. That is the nefarious, true crime, almost trashy divorce, fun with Dunn, Dirty Digs adjacent story of the 7th Earl of Lucan, lucky in his trashy, trashy life.
The 7th, but not the worst.
I don't know.
The other guy really, he killed like tens of thousands of people.
Okay, so we're just going on the scale of killed less people.
Yeah.
Okay. Then 3rd Earl, you win.
Okay, fine. 7th is the worst, but there is actually a competition for it.
Well, everybody forgot about number three.
Well,
when number seven came along. Anyway, that is Fun with Dunn.
The coming next back. Generation.
The Next Generation, Series 200. Next one will be back in April. Oh, and it's good. I'm so excited. Thanks, y'all, for listening and supporting us. Wash your hands, wash your face, social distance.
We're going to get through this.
Yeah, we're all going to get through it together. And I'm going to send this out to everybody so everybody has something to do today. Fun with Dunn is back.
Hashtag, Tuesdays. Hashtag in this together.
Tuesdays just got a lot more fun.
With Dunn.
Ha. Cheers, friends. Keep it trashy.
Bye.
Bye.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Hi, I'm Chris Gethard, and I'm very excited to tell you about Beautiful Anonymous, a podcast where I talk to random people on the phone. I tweet out a phone number, thousands of people try to call. You talk to one of them, they stay anonymous. I can't hang up. That's all the rules. I never know what's going to happen. We get serious ones. I've talked with meth dealers on their way to prison. I've talked to people who survived mass shootings. Crazy funny ones. I talked to a guy with a goose laugh, somebody who dresses up as a pirate on the weekends. I never know what's going to happen. It's a great show. Subscribe today, Beautiful Anonymous. Hi, I'm Chris Gethard, and I'm very excited to tell you about Beautiful Anonymous, a podcast where I talk to random people on the phone. I tweet out a phone number, thousands of people try to call. You talk to one of them, they stay anonymous. I can't hang up. That's all the rules. I never know what's going to happen. We get serious ones. I've talked with meth dealers on their way to prison. I've talked to people who survived mass shootings. Crazy funny ones. I talked to a guy with a goose laugh, somebody who dresses up as a pirate on the weekends. I never know what's going to happen. It's a great show. Subscribe today, Beautiful Anonymous.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
I'm making Just keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros. Two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
Your son is snacking.
Now, be sure we get all the delicious cat crunching in the background.
Yeah, no,
it's awesome. Mm-hmm. It's awesome. Mm-hmm. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, Alicia.
Welcome to Trash Candy Connoisseur.
It's Cinco de Mayo. That's all all we need to focus on. It is Cinco de Mayo. And Taco Tuesday.
Are hard shells or soft shells better?
We inexplicably slept until noon today. I'm not even sure.
We didn't really sleep. You slept. I didn't sleep.
Well, I didn't sleep. The cats got me up at 4 and I was up till about 8. So, yeah. Anyway, it's been a weird day.
Hi, listeners. You probably don't care about any of this and how time is meaningless, but maybe you feel like time is meaningless in your world too. We're all just in the same day, man.
It's
all the same fucking day.
Largely true.
Yeah. Yes. Anyway, so we're here today.
Yeah.
For a little trashy literature.
Sure. Or really, this is really inspired by your recent forays into April in Paris and the lives of interesting women who did it their way.
Are we spending May in London?
I don't know if we're spending May in London. We're spending Cinco de Mayo in London.
Let's do it. Cheerio.
So I have a story I've called Loose Women, the Vita Sackville-West story.
Fantastic.
So Alicia, you have been highlighting these amazing stories of women who built incredible, unique, and even liberated lives in Paris in the 19th and 20th centuries. I've got one for you from across the channel.
Perfect.
So a lot of people know the name Vita Sackville-West because of her decade-long relationship with Virginia Woolf, but in their own time, it was actually Vita who was the more well-known writer and much better-selling of the pair, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, Virginia Woolf's writing is challenging. It's, you know, I think Vita was writing more kind of mainstream stuff. And anyway, so we're going to talk about her.
Do it. This is great.
I feel like the story gets told a lot from the perspective of Virginia Woolf, or from... from the exploration of Virginia Woolf's life. And so I'm trying to just, like, we're going to talk about Vita Sackville West, and Virginia Woolf is a player in her life, but that's
okay. I can't wait to hear it.
Okay. Vita is from a fancy old English family. Her father was the third Baron Sackville.
Oh.
And her lineage is full of surprises. Vita's mother, Victoria, was the illegitimate daughter of the second Baron Sackville and a Spanish dancer named Josefa de Olivia Pepita.
Holy cats.
As her friends knew her. And Pepita's mother, in turn, had been an acrobat.
Oh my God.
Who married a barber.
Fantastic.
And keep in mind back then, barbers, he may well have been doing surgery as well as trimming beards and cutting hair. Like, this is like...
There were no medical degrees. It didn't matter.
So, Victoria, Vita's mom, was the daughter of...
Come for the haircut, stay for the incision.
Stay for the appendectomy. So Victoria is Vita's mom. She's the daughter of Lionel Sackville West, second Baron Sackville. And Victoria married Lionel Sackville West, the third Baron Sackville, her cousin.
No.
It's so gross.
The heart wants what the... land deed says.
And then Victoria gave birth to Vita, whose given name is Victoria. What?
Oh, God.
There are just far too many Lionels. And Lionel Wolf is... is that right? Is it Lionel or Leonard? I think it's Leonard. Never mind. Anyway,
boom, boom.
Lots of Lionels, lots of Victorias in the story. So she became known as Vita to distinguish her from her mother, Victoria.
Okay. That makes sense.
Vita was born March 9, 1892. She's a Pisces. Mm-hmm. And she grew up in an English country estate in West Kent called Knowl.
Nice.
That had been in the family since Queen Elizabeth I gifted it to Thomas Sackville centuries before.
No way.
Way. So very old money, very established peerage, all of that.
You said Elizabeth I, like...
Oh, yeah.
500,
Queen Elizabeth
I. 500 years of, yeah.
300 years before, yeah, give or take. She was 15.
Yeah, that's landed. Okay.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. No, they'd landed long before. Okay. So her parents had sort of a distant marriage. They were apparently quite happy when they first married, but then dad took a mistress and then moved the mistress in at Knowl with the rest of the family. And
no.
And then Victoria was like, well, if this is how it's going to be, Lionel, then I too shall have lovers. And so J.P. Morgan was one of her lovers.
Oh, my God.
And I think that her true love, she had like a 15-year-long, affair, I guess, but like 15-year-long relationship with someone named Sir John Murray Scott. And like he had... Like, Vita spent time at his house in Paris quite a bit, or his apartment, or whatever. I mean, this was just... I always see in these stories, like, while open marriages were unusual for the day, but all of the marriages were
apparently
open.
Yeah. Whether you knew about it or not, everybody's fucking around with everybody else.
I think the Sackville West family knew what was up.
Yeah.
Okay. Vita was quite isolated from other children when she was young. So initially she was homeschooled by governesses and, you know, as like a 5-year-old or whatever, she wasn't really running in an age-appropriate peer group because there were just adults around. I think she was also an only child. I know her cousin ended up inheriting, her male, sorry, cousin ended up inheriting Knowl. Understandably, the exquisitely complex dynamics of her home life combined with distance from people her own age turned her toward writing, and she never left it.
Curious that.
She would attend Helen Wolfe's very exclusive school for rich girls in Mayfair, where she met two of her early loves, Rosamund Grosvenor and Violet Keppel. Rosamund, born September 5th, 1888, of Virgo, 4 years older than Vita, and Rosamund was 10 when they first met. So, okay, the second... Boer War in South Africa broke out when Vita was about 7, and her dad, you know, I mean, he's a peer of the realm, went off to fight. Boer is Dutch for farmer, which gave me some insight into what this is all about. But like, I could not tell you the geopolitics of the Boer Wars.
Get on that.
Anyway, Pops leaves. Vita is crushed, devastated, sad, terrified. Her mother, Victoria, invites Rosamund to come stay at Knoll to keep Vita
that's
company.
Nice.
And this kicks off a lifelong family friendship with them.
Oh.
And when they become teenagers, it will turn romantic. I don't think 10-year-old Rosamund was up to anything bad with 6-year-old Vita, but hopefully not. In 1911, I think Vita was about 18 at this point, she, Rosamund, and a governess took a holiday to Florence. And by this point, Vita and Roddy, as was her nickname, were very, very much in love. And the next year, Roddy joined the Sackville Wests at their home in Monte Carlo.
In Monte.
Stayed for 3 weeks. Wow. Apparently, by the end of this, Lady Sackville, like Vita's mom, was just like, I hate Rosamund. She's so over her.
Oh, is she over Rosamund or is she over the fact that maybe her daughter's sleeping with Roddy?
So it's a fair question because Vita has no shame about any of this.
Yeah, Rosamund sounds delightful.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So, you know, certain things were expected of young ladies of proper bearing, regardless of how they felt about life. And so around this time, Vita was being courted by several male suitors. There was Lord Granby, wildly rich and the inheritor of a very old family title. He earned like £100,000 a year. He had a ton of land. And Vita's parents were like, yeah, welcome, son-in-law.
Fantastic.
Then there was this other person.
Oh, no.
Harold Nicholson, born November 21st, 1886, a Scorpio. Harold was a young diplomat. His annual salary was about £250. And his family had entered the upper crust only recently when his father had been made a peer by Queen Victoria.
Huh.
Vita found a discreet, independent-minded young man who placed no particular constraints on her in exchange for the same considerations. Because it turns out both of them were bisexual, and Harold very likely was a gay man. Like, I think in a different time, he would have, like, in modern times, I think he would have married a man. Like, I think he would have happily lived life as a gay man.
So it sounds like they made a convenient arrangement.
They did.
Hey, let me ask you a quick question.
Uh-huh.
You said Violet Keppel?
Violet Keppel, yes.
Are you going to talk more about her? Mm-hmm. Is she related to Alice Keppel?
Yes, that's her. Alice is her mother.
No way.
Yes, and Violet will go on to have a long relationship with the daughter of the Singer sewing machine, for like the heiress of she's part of your Romaine Brooks crowd. Like she had a relationship. Like yeah, they all tie together.
Winnaretta. There you go.
Apparently, Virginia Woolf like claimed to have had a fling with Winnaretta as well.
Dude.
Lots of...
Sisters are doing it for themselves.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just heard Keppel and was like, uh-huh. I wonder if that... Mm-hmm. Sorry, please continue.
Yeah, Alice Keppel is her mother.
Fantastic.
And
who is the mistress of Fast Eddie the...
Really?
Seven? Yeah.
Oh, fascinating.
We talked about Alice Keppel.
I thought the name sounded familiar.
Is Camilla... Her
grandma. Okay, yeah. So Charles goes and finds her jewelry all the time and
correct.
Purchases.
That's Alice Keppel.
Amazing.
Okay, trash candy, spider webs. Whew. It all comes back around.
All right, well, I'm glad we're doing this. Okay. So they courted for 18 months. Vita says that during this time, there was never so much as a kiss shared between them.
Well, that's convenient.
Mm-hmm. She married him in 1913 at the age of 21.
Wow.
Her parents were opposed.
Naturally.
Yeah, which is more than a little ironic, since I think a lot of the attraction between the two was the permissibility of an open marriage, like, I don't know, Vita's parents had.
Right.
Free love. Okay.
Do as I say.
So both Vita and Harold enjoyed same-sex relationships throughout their many, many decades together. And they genuinely, I mean, a different kind of marriage, certainly, but... Like, I think they had a really good marriage. Life is funny. Okay. So this triggers Rosamund Roddy to break up with Vita. She's just like, I'm out. I can't believe you're marrying this guy. I'm done.
Oh, poor Roddy.
Yeah, she does well. It's fine. All these people have a lot of money and English country homes and all, like...
Poor, it's not the worst.
Poor Roddy. Yeah.
Poor Roddy.
No, the Grosvenor name, her family was William the Conqueror's gamesman, master hunter or something.
Holy cow.
Yeah, these people are, don't waste your time feeling too bad for these people. It's, they're okay.
Poor Roddy has a broken heart, and I feel bad about that.
Yeah. All right, Harold's diplomatic work took him abroad often, and so after he and Vita married, their first home together was in a suburb of Constantinople, not Istanbul.
Fantastic. This is amazing.
She became pregnant with their first son, Benedict, in 1914, and so they came back to England to make sure that she would give birth with English doctors.
Okay.
And then World War I broke out, so they were kind of homebound for a few years. They had another son in 1915 who was stillborn, and in 1917, their son Nigel was born. So that is their childbearing.
So two boys.
Two boys, yeah. Okay. And so I need to be really careful about making it seem like there are clear delineations in the timeline of Vita's many loves, because there are not. There are not clear delineations there. So Violet Keppel, born 6 June 1894, a Gemini, is another schoolmate from Helen Wolfe's. She also had become a lover of Vita's during their teenage years.
Ooh,
while
la, la.
Rosamond was her primary. Yeah, right? Tricky.
Poor Roddy.
And then, like, her family bugged out. The king died, and they went into, like, their family went into, like, a two-year period of mourning or something and, like, kind of disappeared from the social circuit.
Yeah, because her mom was fucking the, like, it, yeah.
Wow, that makes so much sense now.
Yeah. Because her mother was the long time...
Edward the Seventh?
I think Eddie the Seventh, yeah. Permanent mistress of the king for, oh my like, God. 30 years or something
I was,
crazy.
Because that's so funny. Because when I read that like, Edward the Seventh died, and so her family just, like,
it
left
all comes
to the country
around.
To mourn, to formally mourn for, like, oh, a long time, like 2 or 3 years.
All comes anyway. Back around on the guitar. Trash
so,
candy.
Okay, so... So trashy mom allows Violet to, I'm kidding. Anyway, Violet, you know, returns to social life at the end of this period of mourning, reaffirms her love for Vita.
Okay.
And because Vita is now engaged, she becomes engaged.
Oh, the classic.
Retaliatorily.
Perfect.
I will make
classic
you jealous.
Classic move.
So Vita, of course, marries anyway, but in April of 1918... She and Violet head off to Cornwall for a while.
Oh! well, sure, Cornwall's lovely we'll this time of year we'll, for a holiday.
We'll trip with my pal. So World War One ended...
We like to birdwatch together.
Yeah. So World War One ended on the 11th of November in 1918.
Okay.
Within days, these two were in France together.
Oh, my.
For months.
Fantastic. I love this story.
And so at this point, Violet is engaged to her future husband, Dennis Trefusis. And because of the intensity of her relationship with Vita, she made Dennis promise that they would never have sex or she would not marry him. And Dennis agrees. Marries her anyway.
What kind of... Whoa. Okay.
I do not have any information on Dennis being, like, also, like, privately gay and, like, that's cool because he wasn't planning to
Maybe
anyway.
Maybe he's ace and he's like, that works just fine for me.
Yeah, I don't... That does not appear to be what the story is. So, a few months later, late in 1919, Violet and Vita head back to France for a couple more months. Violet's mother at this point sits Dennis down and was like, listen... I don't know when this all started, but those two are fucking, and they're going to France because they can fuck there and no one cares, and you need to go get your wife and tell her to stop fucking Vita Sackville-West.
Oh, my God.
So he does.
No!
And then in February 1920, off they go again. This time, both of the husbands team up, because at this point, Vita is over in France, like, dressing as a man, going by the name Julian, like... Like, living as a
Hanging
man.
Hanging out with Natalie Barney.
Almost certainly. I mean, yeah. It didn't come up in my research, but it's hard to imagine that they were not in the same circle.
Well, I mean, that's what their circle, like, yeah.
No, that's the circle.
Fantastic. Mm.
Okay, so, and, I mean, Harold works for, like, the Foreign Office or what, you know, like, he's a diplomat for the British government, and stories are circulating, like, rumors are
getting... wife is a crossdresser named Julian.
With a lesbian lover, yeah.
This is amazing.
Yeah. So, the husbands team up.
Oh,
they
God!
Hop into a 2-seat aeroplane, fly across the channel, and there were loud words publicly exchanged in France on the way to the men retrieving their wives.
Oh my God. We thought Victoria and Tenny would make a hella movie. This would make a hella movie.
Yeah. So they snuck off together a few more times through like 1922.
Doesn't sound like they're sneaky.
But Harold became more firmly against the romance. It was... like,
you're embarrassing me.
Reputations sure. are so important at this level of English society. So at some point he threatened to divorce Vita if she didn't knock this off. Dennis is like, you know what? I know how to fix this. We're moving to Italy.
No.
And so off they go. And I think Dennis died like within a decade or so. And so anyway, when Violet returned to England for World War II, they reconnected as friends. I don't know that they rekindled their romantic relationship, but yeah.
Yeah.
But they were friends for the duration. And for her part, Violet would go on to strike up a long relationship with Winnaretta Singer, an ex of Romaine Brooks.
Yeah, they were totally in that set. Yeah, I knew what they were doing on Fridays
and
in 1920 in Paris.
Romaine lived in Italy mm-hmm. for a while, too, and mm-hmm. others went down because they were kind of drawn to Mussolini and fascism. Is that right?
Correct. Who? Romaine and Natalie went to England. They were kept inside the gates by, like, Mussolini, and they went down with Ezra Pound.
Oh, right, right.
They sunbathed in Mussolini's garden. It was awesome.
In Italy.
Fascism okay. is cool. Is that Italy, Mussolini?
Yeah.
Okay.
You said England.
Sorry.
Which
there's a whole lot of fascism going on in the 19th century, the 18th century. So I get a little.
No, Harold was at one point friends with the guy who would go on to form the British Union of Fascists or something.
No.
Yeah. To be clear, Harold was not a British
fascist himself. Okay.
Anyway, okay. So Vita was writing throughout all of this period. So there was a lot of poetry. She was also churning out about a novel a year through like 1926, and many of these were bestsellers. In 1923, she published a book called Challenge in the United States. It was banned in the United Kingdom until 1974.
What?
And the book is the story of Julian.
Oh my.
And his stormy relationship with Eve.
Violet.
Who is a poorly disguised Violet.
Yeah. Aww.
And in there's a movie called Vita in Virginia that I watched on Amazon Prime as part of this. And Isabella Rossellini plays her mother, Victoria.
Interesting.
And one of the first scenes, actually, I think the first scene including Victoria, she's got a copy of this in her hand. And she's like, if you publish this here, I'm cutting you off. This is not fiction. This is about your affair with that woman. And like throws it down.
Oh,
And the two little boys are there eating sweets and just watching this like dramatic confrontation between mom and daughter.
Oh my.
Anyway, so it was not, again, Vita Sackville-West just did not care to
hide.
Have
you met a Pisces? I don't. Come on. Pisces don't have time for your bullshit.
All right. So Rosamond is gone. Violet is gone. And in 1922, Vita meets fellow writer Virginia Woolf.
Yeah.
And is, I think, entranced by her just from go. And they developed a very warm relationship that sort of... Virginia Woolf very famously, like, the things said about her are, like, she was frigid or whatever. Like, I hope that we have sort of moved into a phase where those sorts of descriptors are not, like, Virginia Woolf was a trauma survivor, and, you know. Okay, so it did gradually become romantic between them over the course of a few years. Scholars put them together as a couple from about 1925 to 1935.
Wow.
But Vita's friendship with Virginia and her husband Leonard was also creatively rife and professionally beneficial to all of the above. Virginia Woolf. Born Virginia Stephen on January 25th, 1882. An Aquarius. Mm-hmm. She was 10 years Vita's senior and hailed from a wealthy London household, but not aristocratic, like upper middle class, okay. I think is. So there actually was a class difference between the two because Vita is nobility and Virginia was not. So her childhood included significant trauma with apparent sexual abuse at the hands of an older brother. The household actually included 8 children, including 3 from her mother's first marriage. From which she had been left a widow. So she had 3 siblings who were significantly older.
Okay.
And so one of those brothers, it turns out, was not a good guy.
That's bad.
Yeah. Then, Virginia's mom dies of influenza when she's 13. Mm. And then her older sister, again, part of that cohort of oldest kids. So this older sister had stepped in to fill the maternal role and look after the younger kids.
Okay.
She dies in 1897, 2 years later. Virginia's life got...
tragic.
Mm-hmm. So, Virginia herself quite famously lived with mental health challenges throughout her life that first appeared during this period of just intense loss and familial dislocation. Her dad will die, I think, in 1904. Just a rough run.
Yeah.
All right. So that said, it was a bookish and creative family. And aside from the formal and informal education that all were treated to, their father had a humongous library and all of the children were encouraged to read. The kids had their own little newspaper for a while.
Nice.
Yeah. The Atlanta Atlas.
We do on our street. We have the Atlanta Atlas. Our neighborhood kids make a paper and it's $20 for...
a year or something.
A half a year subscription, I think.
Whenever they feel like asking for money.
I love it. It's my very favorite thing that happens, the Atlanta Atlas.
It's all handwritten. Anyway, all right. So, they would document the goings-on at their home. And Virginia would eventually study at the ladies' department at King's College of London because education was completely segregated by gender. So, dad dies in 04, and then Virginia and some of her sort of contemporary siblings, not the older set, move to the Bloomsbury district in London's West End, where it was cheaper, bohemian, and basically perfect for a bunch of creative kids suddenly on their own in their early 20s.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
See, Broadway musical coming on.
Yeah. And her sister Vanessa was a noted painter of the time, and okay. It was the dream. I mean, the Bloomsbury Group was the dream.
Right.
So their home became a hub for writers, thinkers, artists. Eventually, it came to be known as the Bloomsbury Group. And it was in this circle that Virginia got to know Leonard Woolf, a fellow writer who would formally propose to her in 1912. She was not quick to say yes, but eventually she did acknowledge that maybe marrying him would not be the worst thing. And so they married on August 10, 1912.
Okay.
And I don't want to understate the gravity of the mental health struggles that Virginia was living through. She attempted suicide many times in her life, including shortly after she got married, which must have been, her marriage to Leonard Woolf was very interesting, but he did a lot of work to support his wife, who was frequently in bouts of cataclysmic depression or similar. I don't know. I'm not sure what the thinking is on what her diagnosis would be if she were alive today.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yes, a few months after they get married, she attempts suicide. And after her first book is published in 1915, she attempts suicide. I think she just gets so exhausted by events And it, I don't know, it happened to, obviously she will eventually die by suicide in 1941.
It's terribly tragic.
It is, yeah. At the same time, Virginia Woolf pioneered a new style of writing and is considered one of the masters of modernist literature, 20th century literature, which contrasts her with Vida, whose admiration for the classical style of writing is likely why her lover, less appreciated in their own time, has so eclipsed her in the public mind.
Hmm.
1917, the Wolfs found Hogarth Press to publish Bloomsbury Group writers, including Virginia. And as her friendship with Vida intensified, Vida signed on to publish with Hogarth, which was eventually a big financial help to the imprint. So Vida releases a book called Seducers in Ecuador, which came out around the same time that Mrs. Dalloway was released and soon overtook it on the bestseller list.
Ooh.
There was sort of a creative rivalry between the women.
Okay.
But it was one that, like, creatively Virginia always won because she was, like, opening up new approaches in literature. Like, she was expanding what it meant to be a writer.
Okay.
To write fiction. But commercially, Vida was always outpacing her. It was
interesting.
Mm-hmm. So Vida and Virginia had one of the more creatively fertile partnerships that I can think of.
I wonder how they felt about oatmeal raisin cookies.
I think they understood that chocolate chip is the superior.
Stay tuned for trashy tidbits, friends.
Mm-hmm. Vida's boldness and her clarity of self-image, she understood herself to have two distinct halves, one feminine and attracted to men, and one masculine and attracted to women, inspired Virginia, and Vida was diligent in her praise and encouragement of Virginia and her work. This apparently resulted in a fairly fulsome reappraisal of, like, Virginia's own life by herself, like Virginia reconsidering sort of her own view of herself, and it also helped her to find better coping strategies to support her mental health, because in this era, I am ashamed to report that in this era, when women had brain troubles, what the doctors and her father always advised was like, well, you need to stop using your brain then. If your brain's driving you, you need to stop reading, you need to stop writing.
It'll hurt you.
You need to go out,
think too much,
back and dig a hole, wear yourself out. That's how you, then you come in and you go to bed and you stay in bed. You do not.
Don't think.
Yeah, don't think.
Dude.
And of course, the things that Virginia loved were reading and writing and thinking. Yeah. So yeah, she had been, it had been drilled into her that all of these things that she enjoyed and were meaningful to her and gave her purpose were damaging to her. And along comes Vida, like, no, dude, you don't need to go dig a hole out back. Like, read a book. Like,
you're cool.
Do stuff you're interested in doing.
Yeah.
Ginny. All right. So, yeah, Vida was like, yo, that's totally dumb. You love reading. You're a once in a generation writer and you hate doing all this working out stuff. So, what are we doing
in the
here?
Back? Yeah, it's ridiculous. Waste of time.
So, indeed, Virginia's day-to-day struggles, they did seem to diminish. And so while Seducers in Ecuador was not, like, the biggest hit that Vida ever released, her next book, The Edwardians, was a huge, it sold, like, 100,000 copies in 6 months.
Wow.
Made Hogarth a ton of money. Virginia, meanwhile, spent several years of their time together composing Orlando.
Yeah.
A book that Vida's son has called the longest and most charming love letter in literature.
Aww.
The story follows a gender-switching protagonist across centuries of time during which he and or she never ages, having adventures, falling in love, traveling with the Romani people, which Vida identified strongly with that because of her, I guess, her Spanish heritage.
Okay.
I don't know.
The acrobat heritage.
The acrobat heritage, uh-huh. Yeah. And the book, the story ends at midnight on the day of the book's publication, which is super meta. I have not read Orlando, but I've seen the Tilda Swinton film version of it a few times. And all right. So according to a write-up, just a little essay on the Vida Virginia romance by Maria Popova on brainpickings.org, quote, on October 11, 1928, the day Orlando published, Vida received a lavish package containing a pristine copy of the book and Virginia's original manuscript, custom bound for Vita in Niger leather.
Aww.
Her initials engraved on the spine.
Aww.
Interestingly,
that's a love letter.
Orlando's publication appears to have marked kind of the beginning of the end of their romantic relationship.
Oh, no.
So Vita...
1928 is a tough year on lesbians.
Yeah, yeah. But again, they're technically linked romantically through 35. So, it was a long... I think the idea is like between like 26 and 28 was sort of the most intense period of their time together.
Okay.
But again, Vita was seeing other people too. Like, I don't know. So after Orlando comes out, Vita starts becoming annoyed that Virginia's apparently sort of like sitting at home writing these epic fantasy stories starring her. But in real life, she was not super effusive in her
love
and her affections. Yeah.
Huh.
And so Vita's like, well, wait a minute. Like, I'm more than just a character for your writing. Like, I'm a human. I have needs. So, you know, probably a common hazard for creatives. So from Virginia's side, the fact that Vita was also having affairs with other people in the Bloomsbury group and
sure.
somebody from the BBC and like a fling with a journalist and the journalist's girlfriend, a female journalist, I shouldn't. Yeah. So the Popova's piece on brainpickings.org includes part of a letter that Vita sent to Harold shortly after he met Virginia. Quote, I simply adore Virginia Woolf and so would you. You would fall quite flat before her charm and personality. Mrs. Woolf is so simple. She does give the impression of something big. She is utterly unaffected. There are no outward adornments. She dresses quite atrociously. At first you think she's plain, then a sort of spiritual beauty imposes itself on you, and you find a fascination in watching her. She was smarter last night. That is to say, the woolen orange stockings were replaced by yellow silk ones. But she still wore the pumps. She is both detached and human, silent till she wants to say something, and then says it supremely well. I've rarely taken such a fancy to anyone, and I think she likes me. At least she asked me to Richmond, where she lives. Darling, I have quite lost my heart.
Aww.
So, as the years rolled on, Virginia became increasingly frustrated by Vita's promiscuity, her adherence to the British class structure that privileged her above so many women, and a room of one's own is sort of a direct repudiation of, I don't know, Vita's life. And that was in 1930. Like, I think Virginia was trying to have a conversation with her about it that Vita couldn't have. So yeah, later, Virginia Woolf was a lifelong pacifist, and she really got upset about Harold's friendship with this guy who forms the British Union of Fascists. And by the time the British Union of Fascists had come into being, Harold was no longer associated with the guy, but it was still, like, you don't go full Nazi overnight, right? Like,
yeah.
There's a gradual buildup.
It's a grooming process.
Yeah. So by 1935, you know, war was on the horizon, and there were just tensions, and the romantic part ended. Virginia would live 6 more years. She would fall into a deep depression and become obsessed with death as their London home was destroyed in the war. So March 28, 1941, she fills her coat pockets with stones and walks into a river.
It's the saddest.
Yeah, it was like a month before they found her body, too. Rough.
Really? Wow.
All right. So Vita went on to live until 1962.
Really?
She died of cancer that June at the age of 70.
Wow.
At her home, Sissinghurst Castle. She apparently designed amazing gardens there. And then the National Trust took it over after Harold died 6 years later. Anyway, by the time the 1940s got underway, there was less appetite for that more classical style of writing. People were very into, like, ooh, stream of consciousness. Virginia Woolf is so good. Anyway.
Have you heard about this Faulkner guy?
Right.
Hey, what about Hemingway?
The American invasion, as it were. Okay, so, she started to just sort of seem like yesterday's news professionally, and That did not thrill her, obviously. But she became a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature in 1947 and a Companion of Honor, which maybe is the only thing I'm not sure. Those things were together in the Wikipedia entry, so I'm not sure when women could be full members of the Royal Societies. Anyway, Harold outlived her by a few years, dying in May 68 at Sissinghurst as well. He was 81. And their son Nigel would go on to publish works by and about his parents, including Vita's, like, 1923, not very fictional portrayal of their marriage, Portrait of a Marriage, in the 70s.
Interesting.
And it was, like, super queer.
Yeah.
Just super queer. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the best of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. Would have been banned. Anyway, so, yeah, there's Vita, man.
That was a great story. I had no idea.
And Harold,
too. That was a hell of a story.
I really do recommend the, I mean, if you're into this type of story, the movie Vita and Virginia was a really interesting look at two very interesting marriages.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That was well done.
Hey, thanks.
Stacey.
Thanks.
Hell of a story.
We'll overlap with what you've been doing.
I love it.
Cross the channel.
I love it. See, this story just gave me another idea about who I'm what I'm going to do next.
Good.
Ha-ha.
Good.
Serving volley back to you, lady.
There's another one I have in mind from, like, before this period, but fascinating.
If I can find
enough source to actually do a story on it.
Y'all, thanks for tuning in.
Yeah.
You're the very best. Thank you so much for your support.
Happy Cinco de Mayo.
And happy Cinco de Mayo and trashy love. And I hope everybody gets an oatmeal raisin cookie today.
Lies.
Or chocolate chip, whatever you like.
Perfect.
Your choice. There's no good, there's no bad.
Don't disappoint raisins.
Oh my God. Just walk on by, Renee. That leaves me more oatmeal raisin cookies. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. You're the very best. Until we talk to you again, keep it trashy.
Stay trashy, everybody.
Quite trashy. In your English country home.
Which, again, there's no amount of cleaning that will get those clean. There's not.
Cheers, friends. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye. Oh, I gotta stop it, don't I? And thanks to you for listening. Trashy Divorces is a Hemlock Creatives production, created and produced right here in Atlanta, Georgia, by us, Stacy and Alicia, with a little research and writing help from the brilliant Melissa O.
Our art is by Sydney V. Smith. That's Sydney V. Smith at carbonmade.com. And our music is used with permission of Ratsy. Check her out at Ratsy's store on Instagram. And definitely drop into Ratsy's store anytime you're in Oberlin, Ohio.
You can contact us at trashydivorces@gmail.com or find us on the World Wide Web at trashydivorces.com.
If you need more trash candy in your life, our Patreon community includes some of the very best humans around and thousands of hours of bonus content at every level of support. Join the fun at patreon.com/trashydivorces.
Interested in some Trashy Divorces swag? Check out our merch shop and Trash Panda Enthusiasm Society at bit.ly/trashygear.
Want to advertise with us? Reach out to sales@advertisecast.com for more information.
And last but not least, come play with us on social media. I keep most of our Trashy Divorces Instagram hopping. Stacy and I share it up over on Facebook, including our Trashy Divorces podcast discussion group. Come join us over there, and thanks again, everybody, for listening.
Keep it trashy, y'all.